Hello and welcome to another episode of Pod of the Gaps, a podcast which seeks to plug the gaps between the church and the culture. My name is Aaron Edwards and I'm joined by the man in the cabin, Dr. Andy Bannister.
The man in the cabin, that should be my new social media handle. And you, my friend, you are the man with the ever-growing family, because since the last episode of Pod of the Gaps, something quite interesting has happened, I believe.
Yes, yeah, something quite novel, really, in terms of modern civilization. We've had our sixth child, which definitely puts us
amazing. In a unique bracket. That's over halfway now to a football team.
It is. Well, indeed, it's just a six-a-side football team.
Or a six-a-side football team. Or if you want to do rowing, you know, you want a Coxless 8, I mean, to go, two more to go, you can fill an entire rowing boat. What sports team are you and your wife aiming for? Have you got a particular team in mind?
We originally, when we first got married, we were saying four was the amount in mind. But it kind of grows in your, I guess maybe your capacity grows. We were talking to a couple who haven't had any children yet, and they were saying, what's the hardest number? And we would say 0 to 1 is always the hardest. I say always, you only do that once. But it was definitely the hardest, because the biggest amount of change in your life. And then adding more, of course, they are challenges at different points, but really adding a 6 to 5
is mathematically, that's true. It's an infinite number you have to multiply 0 by to get 1, right? Whereas from there on in, it's a diminishing kind of returns. We have got friends locally who have 11, which is
really
boring. Wow. Yeah, in one of our homeschool kind of groups, okay. 11. Right. And the frightening thing is, it's very ordered. You meet them, because you would think, a lot of people listening to this will probably go, 11, that's mental. Most of the, I can't speak for your particular establishment, but actually I can. Most homeschool families I come across with very large numbers. We had friends in Canada who had 10. It is amazingly well organized, which just strikes me as interesting. I think probably because you have to be. I think if you're going to have a family of that size, you have to really put structures down and get the older ones helping with the younger and all those kind of things.
But yeah, that's essential, really. It can work negatively at those higher end numbers, because the elder siblings end up, which they do anyway, which is a good thing for them to learn to help and be responsible for others. But some younger siblings in mega families end up complaining that they weren't really parented by their parents, and they're closer to that eldest sibling as their kind of figure.
That can happen in smaller families, in that we've only got two, but my 11-year-old daughter insists on trying to parent her 8-year-old brother.
I think she tries to parent our children as well. So,
yes, most causes squabbles in our household come when Katrina is trying to not be a sibling and to be a parent. She's going to make an amazing leader one day, although she's very drawn to the idea of absolute monarchy. She's like, Dad, I think democracy doesn't work. I think absolute monarchy is the model. And when you ask, does that mean, like, who would the absolute monarch be? She went, well, I think I'd make a good choice.
So now you just need to find her a willing prince. That's your.
Well, I know we have joked, well, therefore, should we write to the royal family? And there are various young princes sloshing around. So yeah, I don't think she's fully worked out the path to it. But it's required.
She'll have to
Google it and see if she can find the answers.
Shoot for the stars. There we go. Yeah.
Yes.
Good.
The reference to Google, by the way, I was trying to throw you an easy segue to today.
Easy segue. Sorry, I'm blind. The new baby's blinded my, you know, segue.
Yes, the problem gaps listeners. Aaron's mind is blinded by new babies. So this episode, rather than dig into one of the standard gaps in the culture between the church and whatever and the culture, we're going to talk about, you know, which diet, which nappies are best, and, you know, sleep training regimes, and whether it should be Farley's Rusks or something. No.
That's right. But it was all sorts of sponsors we could have got for this episode, couldn't we?
Well, how many kids do you have to get before you get sponsors? Like, I always think it's interesting that if you'd had 6 kids in one go, when your wife first fell pregnant, if you produced 6, you'd have had sponsorship landing on you and all those things, because the, you know, those large sort of multi-number pregnancies, you know, make headlines and get sponsorship. If you have the 6 over 12 years, whatever it is, you don't get like Pampers knocking on the door saying, would you like a lorry load of nappies?
No, that's true. In fact, well, it is funny though, isn't it? As we were just discussing before we went on air, as it were, the dial, the Overton window is shifting on that, in terms of people are becoming more pro-natal rather than, and there is a wider anti-natalism, but there is increasingly people realizing it. And then there's all sorts of debates as to whether it's a good or bad thing.
Maybe we should have a future episode on natalism. We did an episode. Did we do an episode? I'm losing track now. I think
we did one about how many kids should you have,
or how many have, but I think it'll be interesting to what's interesting now is certainly in the media in recent months, there's been a lot more talk from people, I think, concerned about the fact that demographic trends are dropping everywhere. You know, it's a classic example, isn't it, where I think politically a lot of people miss the ball, that for a long time people got obsessed with population growth, we're going to be too many for the planet. And what was missed was, well, there was this bulge coming through of young people behind that. And of course, for folks listening to this who are like, well, what's the problem? Problem is that actually, particularly in the West, if you don't have, if you don't at least sustain your population, minor things like pensions, who's going to pay your pension? Who's going to look after your old people? Look at Japan right now, you know, huge crisis, but who's going to look after your old people? So huge it's problem. Not as simple as less people.
And the crazy thing is a lot of people, a lot of Christians would have been put off having, they were given their, we were talking about Brave New World earlier as well, they were given their soma, I think, by watching that documentary, Shiny Happy People, which depicted the kind of quiverful movement in the States, you know, the kind of families that would have as many children as conceivably possible.
Often, nice pun there.
And or, yeah, indeed. Often and or sometimes to their detriment. Because they couldn't look after them all adequately or appropriately. There were cases of abuse, etc., and some dodgy theology that came in with it. But the funny thing is, a lot of the stuff emphasized in that documentary, really bad examples, but it would have made people have this, look, see, pat themselves on the back for having their governmentally recommended two children, and then no more, because they wouldn't, how terrible would it be if we ended up like one of these families with 20 children where loads of stuff went wrong as a result? Then that makes you feel better to make the choice that you've just done by following what the basically British Western secular society's told you.
So we'll dig into that in another episode, but you threw another potential link in there to what we do want to talk about today. You mentioned Brave New World.
Please do.
Well, Brave New World is the link. And we were chatting before we pressed record that I was saying that I like a bargain as much as the next person. So I was in the bookstore the other day, and they had a lot of kind of classic fiction, like for a pound. And I on the table was Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. And I realized I've never read it. I'd read 1984, but I'd never read Brave New World. I knew the basic premise. So I thought, well, a pound, you can't go wrong for a pound. You don't like
it. Can I just put, before you go, what does this deal with premise? Who says premise?
I just did.
But like, I've never ever heard anyone say premise.
How would you
carry
say?
Carry on. Premise.
Premise. Well, you know what? Is my North America...
is that what it is? Is it a premise? Is that an America? It could be a Canadian.
Yeah, thing. Maybe a Canadianism, eh?
Back in the bookshop. Sorry, I'm distracting you.
Anyway, so I am... Yes, Brave New World. And of course, the big difference between Brave New World and 1984. In 1984, you've got Big Brother, totalitarian state. You know, the image that sums up 1984, you know, the idea of the jackboot stamping on a human face for eternity.
Forever.
And so there's oppressive state just squishing any resistance. Huxley took a different route and went, well, no, rather than you know, there being force and violence and oppression, his vision of the future was what will happen is people will be distracted to death. So he imagines this future society where the people are just drugged, the soma, which is this pleasure drug that people just take purely their own choice because it makes life wonderful and happy and easy. They're all like sort of potheads. You've got endless entertainment, endlessly available sex, no strings attached. Everyone belongs to everybody else is the catchphrase. And the idea is that, you know, the government, the forces behind the scenes can just run society very, very easily, because in that kind of world, well, why would the herd ever bother rising up? You keep the people happy. And they're not going to raise any questions. And there was a very influential book written in the late 60s, early 70s, when Amusing Ourselves to Death came out. We talked about it on a very early episode of Follow the Gaps by Neil Postman, cultural critic, looking at the way the TV is dumbing us down. And he, his opening chapter sets up the world of Huxley and the, you know, and the vision of Orwell, and argues that actually a lot of people for a long time thought 1984 was where it was going. Postman was like, no, we're heading far more for, you know, Huxley world, where we're going to amuse ourselves to death. And he said this before the invention of, I don't know why I'm waving this around because we don't record the video, the smartphone. And I guess that sets up the topic we wanted to talk about, didn't it? Doesn't it, Aaron?
Yes.
Aaron, because there's been lots of talk in recent months in the media. It's been really interesting how you refer to the window of conversation shifting. More and more and more talk in the mainstream media now about the need to restrict smartphones, especially for young people. More and more schools are finally waking up to perhaps it's the right time to consider, you know, not allowing phones onto the premises. Even governments talking about banning phones for under 16s. And then the book that really has ignited a fire under this, so Jonathan Haidt, the American psychologist, not a Christian but sympathetic to faith, and actually very interesting chapter on faith in this book, his new book, The Anxious generation. And he's got this really, really stunning phrase that struck me when I read the book the other week. He talks about the great rewiring of childhood. So we basically entirely reprogrammed childhood. So most kids are now experiencing childhood through a screen. You know, stat after stat showing the amount of time that kids spend outside playing or doing physical things, crashing, the amount of screen time is going up like a Saturn V rocket. And then with that, massive levels of anxiety and bullying and, you know, other kind of sort of social problems that he would argue now we have the data as social scientists to link to. Not entirely. It's not a one-to-one correspondence, but a very strong correspondence with smartphones, which I guess for me raises the questions, where do Christians engage in all this? As I often, I worry we lag behind the curve. And so lots of churches are still going, well, hey, we've got, you can watch our services on your phone, get your Bible out on your phone during the service. Aren't phones amazing? And before you know it, society will have turned the corner and phones will be seen, you know, as a bit more like smoking, certainly for under these. So I suppose the question is, how do we think about this? And, and perhaps even the bigger question of our very bizarre relationship with technology.
Yeah, it's a good, very good reopening gambit there. I think there's so many things that come up with that. And we have discussed technology in general before, and even in relation to social media in particular. But smartphones are, it is a different kind of topic because it brings something physical of the digital to you, the handheld element of the physicality of your portal to everything going on online, everything in the world, all the information at your fingertips and all of the distraction at your fingertips is just, it's just colossal. Is it a game changer? And as I say that as someone who, you know, I could certainly feel very smug for not having a smartphone, but I absolutely understand why people have smartphones. I think I had one until about, how long ago was it? I can't fully remember. It's over a decade ago. So I had an iPhone for a few years and appreciated the apps and everything else and the online access. But I'm so glad that I don't have one. I still don't. And people say, you know, you're missing out on this and that. You can't join WhatsApp groups, which is inconvenient. And I am an inconvenience to some. When someone has to text me, if I'm part of some group or something, I have to get a text rather than a WhatsApp message or something.
But this, you know, that's so Victorian.
I know, isn't it just? And I do actually, sometimes I miss out on events or information as a result, but you know, you don't know what you don't miss most of the time. And I think it's like, we are in a unique position that we grew up without the internet even. So we do know that it's possible to live and survive without it. I know that culture is now so thoroughly embedded in the digital world that to be a full-on digital Luddite would be very unrealistic. And I think I would suffer from the same distractiveness of social media and all of these, all that's available online as much as anyone. And it helps limit for me not having it in my hand. And when I go out of my house, unless I have my laptop with me, I cannot go online. If I can't find my way to somewhere, I have to ask someone or I have to, interact with a human being in real time, face to face. And I think that can be very helpful to do. And so literally just going out with a phone, with texting and calling is all you've got, because it doesn't do anything else, is extremely freeing. And I've not encountered anyone that I've expressed this to, just when I tell them about, oh, by the way, don't send me any online links to my phone when I give them my number. And they go, oh, you know, I wish. They all say the same thing. I wish I could do the same thing. I'd love to not have a smartphone. They recognize it as, in, you know, Jonathan Haidt's term, as an anxiety-inducing little box in their hand or in their pocket. They know that they're all addicted to it. Everyone is, the adults and the children. And so they yearn not to have that, but they can't bring themselves, wrest themselves from it. And I just think maybe for more people, that drastic action, maybe along the lines of Jesus's, if your right eye, it causes you to sin, pluck it out, might be a good idea, at least a trial for a time.
Well, the trial thing is interesting, isn't it? That I one thing I try and do occasionally, and I'm going to, you know, put my hand up here and say, you know, I have a smartphone. In fact, I was an early adopter. I queued when the iPhone first came out, and I had, you know,
the first ever one.
Apparently now, if I'd kept that in a box and not opened the darn thing, it's worth thousands. It's collector's item, but you know, there we are. You know, I love the tech, and I've always have loved playing around with tech. But yeah, similar to you, begin to recognize the problems. So I think there's a couple of things, aren't there? One is that, you know, trying to just find ways to to become the master of the tool, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. And there are little things you can do, you know, like we try and occasionally go for a walk without a smartphone. That's a radical idea, you know, leave your phone at the home, or if you're driving somewhere, leave the phone in the car. If you're spending a day, I don't know, National Trust property or going for a walk in the country, bad things don't happen. Leave it. And, you know, that feeling being unattached can be quite interesting. Having rooms in our house where phones don't go. So Astrid and I, you know, quite strict. We don't allow phones in bedrooms for a couple of reasons. One is we wanted to model that to our kids. If they do end up with digital devices, they don't have them at the moment, but if they do, so actually having a room, you know, our bedroom is like, there are no digital devices in there. It's quite nice. You know, and it's meant we've had to do Luddite things like, you know, you suddenly realize, oh, hang on a minute, I was using my phone as my alarm clock. So we've had to buy, you know, a little LED alarm clock that kind of sits on the shelf. Yes. So we don't need the phone. I think those kind of things, if you're going to church on a Sunday morning, what about leave your phone in the car and take a print Bible instead of take.
Oh yes,
there are little things you can do. But one thing that Jonathan said in The Anxious Generation, I think that really, really struck me, Aaron, is he talked about, I should have brought the exact quote actually, he talked about the one thing we're not very good at as human beings is think about the opportunity cost. So we're often quite good at seeing what the benefit is. So, you know, a phone brings lots of benefit, or a new car brings lots of benefit, or a bigger house brings lots of benefit, or whatever it is. But we're not so good at stopping and going, okay, there's always a cost. You know, you get a bigger house, okay, the mortgage is bigger. You've got to work hard. You've got to do two jobs now to pay for the mortgage. So there are now some things you can't do because of the choice you made. You know, if you have a phone and a smartphone, that's great. You know, Jonathan's like, there are some absolutely wonderful things you can do, but there are also some opportunity costs that come with that. And so trying to sit down and think a bit more about this. And that reminded me as I read it of course, you know, Jesus talks about counting the cost in that case of discipleship. But also I wonder sometimes if one of the things we've forgotten about as Christians, if we're going to follow Jesus authentically, are there costs that come with that? Not that we don't pay them, but being aware of them. And maybe, you know, if a phone is not a helpful thing, you know, what about going, I'm willing to give that up? Are we willing to pay the price of going, you know what, these things are becoming such a problem.
Yeah.
I'm willing to live without. I'm not quite at your stage, but I find myself far more asking it. And like you say, a number of friends, when you mention that too, if you even say to a friend, I'm thinking of getting a dumb phone, or now you can get dumb phones that will do WhatsApp, for example. So if you desperately need WhatsApp, there is a halfway house. You know, I used to find people laughed at you when, it's like, now I hear far more people go, oh yeah, I was thinking about that. And I was reading somewhere that a lot more of the phone manufacturers are now making far more of these things because there's a growing market, especially, funnily enough, among millennials and younger folks who are perhaps have seen far more than we have.
Well, I recently, because this became a debate in, I mean, I don't precisely know the outcome of the House of Commons was debating it, wasn't it?
The House of Commons was debating, should smartphones be certainly banned selling them to young people. And by the way, just as an aside, folks listening to this thinking that's extreme, one again, point that Jonathan made in the book I thought was very powerful is most smartphones, when teenagers have them, they use for social media. When you sign up for a social media account, you sign a license agreement. When you create an account, you're ticked to say, I've read the terms and conditions. Are we comfortable with a 13-year-old signing across large amounts of their privacy and their data to a multinational company on the side of the world? You wouldn't let that 13-year-old rent a car. You wouldn't let that 13-year-old sign a job contract or a loan, but we're happy to let them tick a box and sign a legal agreement with all kinds of potential ramifications, because that's what happens when you sign up with a social media company.
It's so true. The funny thing about that is you and I homeschool our children, and so we probably have a proclivity to distrust what the state might do with our children's data or our children.
The state have your best interests in mind.
Of course they do. They're the big brother.
What could you possibly mean?
But that's the thing. So I think that so many people, many Christians, haven't thought this through, and they actually still think of, let's say, homeschooling or these kind of Luddite type decisions where you're less on grid as a bit crazy
or quaint.
That's what quaint, strange, but like that's not the crazy thing. Like, as you say, signing your child up to a multinational company or their data, that's the strange thing, that's the quaint thing, that's the odd thing that ought to be thought through and reflected a lot more. So like I've said, I think on the homeschooling episode, I think I would say a default position ought to be, I'm in charge of my child's education and welfare, therefore how might I go about best stewarding that? And then the follow rather than do what the state says, And then if I get round to thinking about it, and if the planets align and our finances align, then we'll make decisions more aligned with what we've actually, our God-given responsibilities as parents.
Another observation as well, by the way, on phones and especially on social media that I think I knew, but I hadn't wholly appreciated till I read the point, the observation in the book, was that, of course, we tend to think when you're engaging, if you're listening to this, if you've got, you know, a Facebook or Instagram or a Snapchat, whatever those technologies you use, you tend to think of yourself as the user, as the customer. You think, well, I'm a customer. I've got a Facebook account. And of course, Jonathan makes the point again, no, you got it totally wrong. You are not the customer. Who is Facebook's customer, Meta Corporation's customer? It's the advertiser. Mm. They're the people who are paying the bills. Yep. When you look at the billions made by Google or Meta or Twitter or X, what was Twitter? Who's paying that? It's the advertisers. Yeah. So it's the advertisers who are the customer, and what's being sold to them is access to your attention and access to your data, but particularly attention. That's what they're paying for. They're paying for technologies that grab your attention. And really interesting deep dive in the book into some of the, because he's as a psychologist looking at is some really interesting stuff he shares on the psychology of how the human mind works and attention and those kind of mechanisms, and the way that basically, effectively, smartphones and the platforms that are on them have hacked human psychology
absolutely
in order to get access to your attention.
Yeah. We've talked before about neural pathways and
absolutely. Rarely goes by when I didn't think about neural pathways.
And indeed, but like, it's something that we talk about a lot. Most people end up talking about this. This debate has been going on for well over a decade, I think there's a propensity to talk about it. Oh, this is a terrible problem, isn't it? Probably like smoking used to be, a terrible problem. You get cancer, and loads of people die as a result of smoking cigarettes in the way they do. And so but it took like a quite significant bit of legislation, which many people who are, you see a lot of things right about culture in general would disagree with that smoking ban, because it would be a kind of, it's a big government thing, isn't it? So again, this House of Commons debate, should smartphones be allowed in schools? That precipitated a lot of discussion again about this issue, not just for children, but for grown-ups as well. And I was really intrigued hearing an online radio debate. I think it was BBC Radio 2 maybe. And it was a few months ago now, and there's a headmaster of a school who was anti-smartphones. And then there was some younger person going, to teacher saying, oh, these are really important. They're essential because of all the interactive learning we do in the classroom, and we're using the QR codes to kind of get onto the online software that they're kind of accessing. And this headmaster, I think in his own school, maybe they didn't use them. And he's making these completely normal, reasonable arguments. And I was kind of thinking, listening to it, well, like, yes, this is insane that this argument even needs to be made. And that anyone in education in our generation would have just seen this and gone, what is the world come to? What is this about? Why do you have to make an argument to say, it wouldn't be, it's not a great idea that students can, pupils can just text each other or send each other messages in the classroom, video one another, take photographs of one another. And I just think, if I was in school and you just pulled out like a Polaroid camera or a video on one of those massive Sony video cameras, and I'm just videoing what's going on, I'm just doing a little prank here and just videoing it. Oh, and here's all the information in the world. I'm just going to access it now. Why do you even have to make an argument that that's a bad idea for like most children in a school and an education environment? It's kind of insane.
Well, the interesting thing in education is that apparently, and if I'm wrong on this, listeners, you can feel free to message us at Pod of the Gaps Towers. There has not yet been any study done showing much in the way of educational benefit of screens in terms of learning. I know lots of schools have leapt that way because it's sexy and it's trendy. But one of the things I find interesting is, again, to bring this back to the church, is the number of churches I come across that have sort of lent towards, trying to digitize, some of their youth curricula. I have I have friends with kids who's, there's a lot of digital screen stuff going on in churches. Even in the church we attend, it's not so bad, but I forget what it was now. They were proposing something. And so I just remember making a comment to the youth leader about some of this stuff, and sent them a link to Jonathan's stuff and others. And it was interesting. The idea has now been withdrawn slightly. Hmm. I think there can be an assumption of going technology is good, because this is the trap, I think, is that we are wired again as human beings, I think, sometimes to think if it's new and if it's technological, it has to be good. You know, if we can do something, we must do something. And we're not always good. We're not always good at asking the other question and going, okay, what are the opportunity costs here? And that, again, I think is something as Christians we should absolutely be able to have a way of speaking into. And by the way, I always think as well, there is such, Aaron, such a gospel opportunity here. Because I think one of the things that's going on here is that smartphones promised us so much. They promised us, you know, infinite knowledge and peace and harmony as everyone comes together on these platforms. They promise us we'll never be alone because there's always someone there at the touch of a button. And they failed spectacularly. It turns out you've got mass ignorance because we're drowning in data. You've got mass tribalism, and loneliness is off the charts. And I think there's a wonderful opportunity as Christians to be leveraging off that in the way that we preach the gospel and saying, again, as human beings, these things that we yearn for, knowledge and truth and connectivity and community, there's a reason we're wired for those, because God's put those desires deep within us. But the tendency we have when, you know, we chase God out as a society, we look for these false gods to fill these things, and they always disappoint. It's like the wooden idols, the stone idols of the Old Testament. And there's a wonderful opportunity to do what Paul does in Athens, I think, and go, this unknown God, in our case, this little mirror, this little black mirror that we're playing with, you know, it's not inherently bad, but it's a toy. It's a cheap imitation of something so much better. So partly, churches and church leaders listening to this, we need to be preaching about these issues. Again, that's a regular theme, I think, on Pod of the Gaps, isn't it? To weave this into our preaching and our teaching. I think people sitting in our pews and our congregations want to hear, you know, thoughtful preaching that reflects on this. We don't change, you know, the gospel doesn't change, but perhaps the human sinfulness finds new ways of expressing itself.
Yes, absolutely. And with that, there's also the kind of part of the creation mandate as well, to say technology is a good thing. It can be a neutral thing in the sense that you can use it well and wield it, and it can be seen as a source of wealth, a source of God's blessing upon a civilization, and indeed us using our God-created ingenuity to find solutions to problems. There's always, in any technology debates, you're always going to get the problem of, well, you're always leaning on some kind of technology that some Luddite at one time would have said, this is a bad idea. Like us having this conversation over Zoom, for example, there are contexts in which you should critique the use of technology. And I would critique digital technology in loads of ways whilst also using it in loads of ways. And you just have to show moderation, as Paul commends us to. And that's really important. So just it's important to be as open as conceivably possible to the good things in technology that help us and that are genuinely can bring glory to God, and not to be scared of that whatsoever. And then at the same time go, right, okay, and yet there's time for feasting and there's time for fasting, and there are reasons for that. And I think there are things that can end up destroying us. So on a societal level, as you say, Jonathan Haidt's point, are we looking at the costs? Are we looking at the dangers that come in? And with smartphones, it does seem that we're in a really low ebb here. And I've got a long quote for you to endure here, Andy. If you want to take any notes, please feel free.
I take notes on everything you say, Aaron.
Of course. No, you don't. You're normally looking at some other screen going, as you were rabbiting on there, looking at this.
I'll take notes on my iPhone.
There
we go.
Yeah, please do. Yes, this is from this is a Rod Liddell article in The Spectator several weeks ago. And it's an article called Kids and Smartphones, An Inconvenient Truth.
Oh, yes.
And so he draws it into numerous other issues beyond smartphones, but it's interesting how he weaves them together. So have a look at this. We give smartphones to our kids for our benefit, not for theirs. Oh. It is the post-toddler equivalent of a dummy. It occupies them, often for entire days at a time, and we are thus relieved of the task of either engaging with them or actually, you know, parenting them. That £1,000 plus smartphone, then, is a gift of neglect masquerading as benevolence. Even if the kids navigate their way through the cyber hell of bullying, spite, vituperation, and explicit porn, they will still cop it because their abilities to concentrate on any issue at hand reduce with every hour that they spend online. This is, but then so many of the developments we've seen over the past 40 or 50 years have been to the detriment of the children. The divorce laws, for example, which ensured that there would be a huge increase in the number of children raised in one-parent families, the worst of all outcomes for the children. Families in which both parents work and have little time left over for their children. The increase in paid-for childcare, enabling parents to park their brats while they go off to work. The longer a kid spends in childcare, the less fortuitous his or her later development, according to the stats. Many of these developments are considered progressive, of course, and in some ways they are. I'm not arguing that women shouldn't go out to work or that we should have no free childcare, but we blithely ignore the unintended consequences, all of which devolve down to the children. They have not been made better off this past half century or so. They are simultaneously indulged financially by parents and the state and neglected. Meanwhile, we worry endlessly about their safety and yet are resistant to measures which might give them greater security because that would impinge upon our freedoms. With kids, we kid ourselves that they are happy. The evidence suggests overwhelmingly that they are not. Thoughts?
My word. As you read it, I was nodding along because I subscribe. And so I read that a few weeks ago. And there are some articles. There was a Douglas Murray one on euthanasia a few months ago that had the same effect on me. Or I almost want to put it down. I almost want to weep because I think he's right. He's absolutely right. And I think, as a society, the challenge is a society that we want to be a compassionate society. I think if you can't ask society as a whole, but I think if you could, if society had a sort of gestalt voice, it'd want to say UK society would want to say we're generous and compassionate and welcoming. And to be fair, lots of time, I think we do get that right. There is that sort of sense of British decency that runs through this culture. And I think European, North American culture too. Most people want to try and do the right thing, but without realizing, we've actually done huge harm to some of the weakest. And we see that in other issues too. Abortion would be one. We've talked around that. No one's set out to be monstrous, but we've ended up there. The euthanasia path that, a lot of Western countries are talking about, again, that's now young people being affected. And then technology, that line about the virtual kind of babysitter. And that stung me because we don't give our kids phones, but what I catch myself doing sometimes and always have to apologize to my kids and beat myself up is if I'm on my phone doing something, like a work email or something, which I shouldn't be doing at 8 o'clock at night, but there we are, and one of my children comes in, often they'll get the sharp end of it. They'll be just a minute. Almost giving the impression that the phone is what matters. Yes. And I try in my parenting, when I'm with my kids to put a phone in another room. I remember how I had the Apple Watch for a while because I love technology. And one of the reasons I gave up on that and went for, I now have a dumb, analog watch. I've got an old-fashioned wind-up thing, is that it was the bleeping and the pinging when I was with my kids. And I think he nails quite a lot of things, actually, that as a society. And the other thing, I can't remember if we talked about this in the previous show, Aaron, the other thing that strikes me is we live in a society where every other commitment is pretty much dissolvable. You're married, you can get divorced. You don't like your job, you walk away. You don't like your friends, you just ignore them. Don't like your social media account, close it, start another one. The one thing that our society is still, even now, considered beyond the pale is child abandonment. If you just left your child at the shopping centre and said, I've had enough, I don't be a parent anymore, you'd be considered a monster. I mean, if you gave up for adoption, people would still look at you a little bit askance, but fine. But child neglect. Because child raising, having children is the one non-negotiable commitment. Because children don't do things on your time. They do things on their time. And my concern is that children then begin to look inconvenient in a society where everything's about convenience and entertainment. Children won't play that game. And then the question becomes in the churches, how do we ensure that we're communities that really value children? There's a question, because that's going to look increasingly countercultural, actually, if we put young people and families front and center. While we don't, we don't disenfranchise those who are single or childless, those folks are part of our community too. But I think children and putting children, to the center a lot of the time is going to make Christians look unique and stand out. But, it was Jesus who said, let the little children come to me.
Absolutely. Amen. That's a really, really good point to kind of bring us in to land, actually, because, as you say, there's something about the care for children. Yes, you can have a sense of child centrism, there are families and parents that helicopter parent and don't actually give their children enough free play where they get to be imaginative. And in many ways, that's part of also the problem of putting them in front, giving them a smartphone just to kind of focus on. And previous generations, postmen would say, well, that's the same as what the TV was. Anything, any kind of technology where you're just leaving them with it and not allowing them to actually express themselves. And they become the consumer. And we all know the neurological studies are really clear. And also learning studies about what information you take in and the way that you actually become more passive, your brain becomes more passive. I mean, when you read a book in print, you tend to be able to engage with it better than when you engage with it in a digital format. So these things do correlate, you know, not just to smartphones, but as we say, that they are things which, this is a kind of technology which brings all of the debates about the digital world that we can have in other spaces right in front of you into a physical object that you have with you at all times. And it really interrupts, it's the digital interrupting with the physical in a really, I say profound way, but it quite troubling way, especially when you're giving it to children when we literally don't even know. And we increasingly do know the some of the negative effects, but we don't know the long-term negative effects societally, even though we're starting to see ripples of it, and it's kind of dangerous. So any Christian parents out there, absolutely heed the significance of how we are to care for and nurture children rightly in throughout scripture, and especially those of you who have been, you know, blessed with children to care for in whatever capacity, and really to think really, really hard about this and think, right, what would it take? Is it my own lack of self-control that I can't get rid of this? So they could say, well, you should have the smartphone and show more self-control. Well, you wouldn't do, there's so many other things where you wouldn't take yourself in line of sight. You wouldn't go and sit in a kind of pornography shop, not that they even have those anymore, whatever, or brothel. You'd just sit down. I'm just going to go and sit down here in a strip club and just not look or something. You wouldn't do that because it's not your lack of self-control. It's just wisdom. It's a lack of prudence. And that's what the Proverbs call us. You don't even go down there. Don't even go down those steps. So there are many ways of thinking about this where we should take more drastic action than we've been willing to. And just to think through that really carefully about the, as you say, unintended consequences.
The other question as well to land on as we pull this to a close, that again, I want to offer this as I'm not someone who's solved this, but I'm working on it. A question I find myself asking is, look, most modern smartphones will tell you the time that you use on them. My iPhone does. It's worth using those tools and then asking yourself, what could I do with that time otherwise? You know, if I didn't have that phone and I've been on that phone for an average of 2.5 hours a day, 3 hours a day, which is the low end, by the way, the average, to go, just what would you be doing with that time? You could invest that time in all kinds of other things. You could invest it in reading the Bible, praying, spending time with family, friends, outside. You mentioned playing, by the way, with kids. The two big takeaways from Jonathan Haidt's book are children need no smartphones and more outside play. Those two things together have a massive push for mental health. And for Christians, I think the Christian version of that is time together in community, either in our families or our churches, and less time at screens. That is a God-given thing, because rather than fill our eyes with stuff that the world has created, you are going to find it much more easier to fill your mind and your heart with things that are of the Lord. It doesn't necessarily be just the Bible, but just the created world that God has made, rather than the plastic engineered world that the social media companies have made. And so the answer to that will look different for each one of us, but I think the first step we found in our lives is asking the question and challenging oneself. But, you know, sometimes, you know, if you find the prospect of being challenged on your smartphone use, your natural response is to go, well, I'm okay. That probably actually means that you aren't. That's classic denial. So what about we bring our smartphone usage under the Lordship of Christ and see what happens?
Amen.
And on that bombshell, this has been Pod of the Gaps. I've been Andy Bannister.
I've been Aaron Edwards.
By the time you listen to this, he might have a seventh child. We shall see.
Who knows? Yeah, I've got previous.
Yeah, we hope you've been listening. We hope the next time the gap will be not quite so big. Aaron has had the excuse of having a baby. Well, not him personally, kind of thing. We'll be back in hopefully a lesser time than there was for the last one with a new topic. And so hope you enjoyed listening. Do share the show with your friends. And again, may the Lord be with you. Bye for now.